Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Viral Wellness. Another week in the pandemic, guys, but we're still breathing. We're still alive. We're still here.
More than breathing, we're living in isolation.
KG, don't leave me, bro. I mean, after 2 weeks of complications, you're finally in Dubai, dude. How's that going?
Yeah, I've spent like 5 days in my room. This wonderful place here.
Are you keeping a journal? Are you keeping a journal? You're like, day four.
I'm not. Actually, should be. The zombies are approaching. I've had to build shelters.
Room services.
With whatever I
not answering.
Could find.
Yeah. I've used
it. You know what? It's been quite cool. I've gotten a lot done. I haven't been, you know, unproductive.
No. Yeah.
We're still going to carry on with the viral wellness because that's just how much it means to us. You know what I mean?
Just nothing can stop us, man.
We know it means a lot to you too.
Yeah, we do. And we're celebrating the fact that our Instagram is steady climbing. I mean, our team has been putting in massive amounts of hard work. Shout out to Gaz, shout out to Yaz and Kibbs and to Jules. Our entire team has been putting in such hard work, and we've been able to. I think our last couple episodes, Cage, have been the best yet, you know, and we're only going to get better. So,
no, exactly. Cheers to that. When did we start this? When did we start this?
Cage, you know, back in 2020, back in March 2020.
Oh, we've grown so much.
We've grown so much, man. And you know what? This is quite cool, this episode. It's a little bit of a throwback, right? This is our first fully digital episode of season two. You know, you're shooting remotely, which is like the good old days, if we can call them that. And it's quite fitting because of our topic of conversation today is focused on the digital space.
Digital universities.
Ooh,
exactly. Yeah. So it actually couldn't be more, you know, relevant. And like, this was a fluke. We didn't plan this, right?
No, we definitely did not plan. I mean, we did not plan this. No. But we didn't plan this yet, and we kicked it anyway. You know what I mean? So,
exactly. Yeah. But before we get into this nitty gritty of this, before we get into the nitty gritties of this conversation, we just wanted to let you know that the length of the podcast changes dependent on where you're listening on the Viral Wellness.
So you guys may have noticed, we've put in a lot of thoughts as to how do we deliver this content, this spreading this viral wellness to you. We've been posting little snippets on our IG. So that's like our, you know, just fun little banter between me and KG. But we've also recently just launched IGTV clips, which are what we're going to be deeming as supercuts, which kind of give you as much time and an overview of the entire episode for your convenience. And we will also be posting these supercuts on YouTube. So it doesn't matter where you're listening from. If you're listening from the full podcast episode on Buzzsprout, which can go anywhere between 45 to an hour and something minutes long, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, no matter where you're at, we got you. And we wanted to let you guys know that from the outset, that we're working hard to deliver it. And we want to know what's your favorite. What do you enjoy the most from us? You know, let us know.
Yeah, exactly. With different platforms, different experiences, and it's just a wonderful platform of the viral wellness. But anyways, back to business. Today's topic focuses on online learning, whether that would be within your own personal capacity or within an institution.
You see, the internet has reduced our access quite drastically. I mean, well, not quite drastically, what should I say? This is a very interesting topic because some people will say that the internet has opened up access to information, but others may argue that the internet is actually taking us away from concrete learning. So you can learn anything through the online platforms now. I mean, I could learn a course on how to open up a bottle, seriously, if I wanted to. These are through tutorials, through blogs, through deep diving research. But what does that actually mean? And is it actually effective? You know, that's what we want to be looking at into today.
Yeah, I mean, you have so many, like, there's this ad that keeps coming up on YouTube. YouTube ads,
But
there's one on Masterclass. Literally,
I love Masterclass, though.
Yeah, right? Like, Timberland was on there. I've seen, was Alec Baldwin
Aaron
on there?
Aaron Sorkin, dude. Martin Scorsese's on there. Rachel McAdams.
There's a lot of people on there.
Rachel McAdams, that would be Natalie Portman. Natalie.
Yeah, but just willing to learn remotely and to learn independently, which is something. It's amazing how the web, you know, has done that for us.
Yeah.
The concept of things like YouTube University speak to that. Whether it's learning how to sing a new language or even getting a perspective on something from across the world, we've grown up in a time where for a great deal of us, encyclopedic information has literally been at our fingertips.
I mean, if you think about it, like
we're in golden era.
In a library.
Cam?
Yeah? Cage?
No, I was saying that. I mean, we're living in a golden era of just...
of information, you know? I mean, the fact that I can talk to you in Dubai in real time, record it for other people to see, that's already a feat, you know? We don't have to look at volumes of books from A to Z and read through them to work out what certain things are. It's literally, we just type them at whatever device we're using, you know? But that obviously has its downfalls as well, because, you know, like we're not always learning from valid sources, where we're getting a lot of perspectives from people like we were discussing in the weeks prior that isn't really wellness information. So that's why we're diving in today, right into the world of formal online learning, to help us get a better understanding of not only the space, but how it operates as well. And with us today, we have, not one, but two guests.
Double the trouble.
Twice as nice.
Our guests this week are some of the trailblazers evolving the way education can happen, both in their own way.
I like that, evolve. We're talking about Karen Wallstra and Colin Northmore. Here they are to introduce themselves.
Okay, so I'm a teacher. I taught for a very long time, and I now work with schools on educational change. So for me, I really believe that we need to change the way we think around schools and get people to explore thinking differently. And for me, it all goes down to the mindset. Whether you're using technology or not using technology, or how you're using technology, it's all related to mindset. So for me, it's about thinking and asking the right questions. And that if you do use technology, it mustn't be the icing on the top. It must be embedded into the way that we actually use it, and it must be meaningful. So not just using it to babysit the children at school or at home, but meaningful use of tech, because I think that that's only one aspect of our lives and our learning, not everything. So that's me.
Like Karen, I've been a teacher for many, many years. I've been a principal for the last nearly 18 years, and have really pushed the schools that I've led to adopt technology as a vehicle for improving the engagement that children have with their learning. I agree entirely with her about the fact that a technology can't just be a gimmick. It can't just be a nice, pretty thing to have in your suitcase. It's got to be deeply embedded in the actual learning process. And you've got to be taking advantage of the things that technology allows you to do that you couldn't do without the technology. Otherwise, you may as well just use the pen and paper. I suppose the most important thing I have to add is that despite all my efforts on this behalf, I've not yet been abducted by aliens. But, you know, I can keep hoping that at some point they're going to notice me because of my great technological advances in the education sphere.
I think this is a case for Men in Black. Wait, do Men in Black find aliens, or?
You know, I feel like they help aliens, you know? But I mean, you know, whatever it is, you know, I think it will add to our efforts at the cause to get you with the aliens, Colin. That's okay. That's okay on our side. It's only right that you know. Everyone has a right to know if aliens exist, which is another thing you can learn on the internet.
Speaking of rights, in last week's episode, one of the things we discussed is the fact that the internet was declared a human right by the UN in 2016. But when we speak to the South African context, access to the internet isn't necessarily a given.
Yeah, and a lot of our activities have been forced to move on to an online space. I mean, one of the most critical of these things is school. I mean, we've already discussed this as a wellness aspect in two episodes recently, but there was this one hilarious video that our team shared with us that was trending on TikTok and Twitter in July of high school kids preparing for oral presentations, and it was hella funny. But at the same time, it should show some of those realities that the schooling that kids are facing these days. Having to school from home with dogs barking and, you know, you can edit and see yourself as... It's kind of terrifying, man. How do you feel about orals in school? Kijk die hond, blaf.
Orals were always interesting. I mean, you know, you'd work on it and you'd work on your presentation and, you know, chest out and, you know, walk up and, you know... I think I always had it... I was always good with words, so I wasn't really baffled by orals. I wasn't really scared of standing in front of a class, you know. Hence, maybe why we're not scared to, you know, do podcasts to thousands of listeners.
Just talk in front of lots of people and you know, even just be other people in front of other people. I mean, I remember once I came back from... I'd just gone over for an acting thing in the States, and then I came back and then I realized I had a speech to do. So I went down at break and I wrote the speech and then I performed it after break. Well, performed it, you see, look at me, actor. And then the teacher was like, oh, Cam, great speech. And I was like, thank you, ma'am. And she was like, but absolutely completely off topic. And I was like, what? Bro, that, it cost me the 1%. Too. It cost me 1% between 79 and 80, bro. Still bummed.
Oh, no.
Still bummed.
Oh, no. Oh, you turned out to be fine, man. I mean...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that you can't hold this back, bro.
You should have just given you the 80%, man.
That's what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like, why people mean, bro? Why people... But you can see from that video, and we'll share it in our description, that kids... you'll be hard on yourself. I think it would be very difficult for
us. Guys, it's the funniest... It's the funniest video ever. Yeah, these kids have to have... These kids have to have more self-will than we ever did within the schools. And some of them were getting interrupted by their parents, by their dogs. Like, I guess when you're in class, like, you just do it. If there's a noise, you don't stop. You just do it.
Your friend's laughing.
That's the thing with online education. Anyway, but you could tell that these were the kids within a middle-classy-ish background. But what happened with those with less access, you know? And as we move into a world where off-site learning is more prevalent, how big of a role does access to internet play within education?
So for me, it's actually creating an awareness of how to use the internet. So the internet for me is there, and there's tons of information. But for me, in terms of learning, it's teaching children or users how to be analytical in terms of what you are using. So yes, you have access to it, but what are you doing with that access? So teaching students to be responsible digital citizens. So not just accepting everything at face value, being critical in terms of what you are reading or accessing, whether it's a YouTube clip or whatever it is, that it's meaningful, and that you draw meaning out of it by researching what you're seeing. So if you see a post, have you verified that that's true? So for me, the access is there, and how are we actually using that access to make meaning of it so that we're not just taking everything for granted?
If I could take a step back from that, because I think making sure that children are discerning about what they pick up online and are taught how to fact check and taught how to reference and check multiple sources, that's all important. But underlying that is an assumption that, based on what's happened with COVID, we know not to be true. And that assumption is that children do have access to data. Children do have access to digital resources. I think, you know, if there's one thing that our country desperately needs for its development, it's a much freer access, especially for education purposes. And I'm starting to see some service providers talking about zero rating particular websites or particular content so that kids are not needing to use up data to access those resources. So before you can start to discern, you've actually got to just basically be able to access the data in the first place. We also know that cell phones are quite ubiquitous. You can find most children have them or can have access to them, but very few websites are designed with a mobile first mentality. So it's often, when you do manage to get that information, it's often very difficult to process or consume or work with that information because it's targeted at a laptop, it's targeted at a computer kind of integration. And then the child struggles because their only device is a cell phone device. But then just my last point on this is just to say, one of my biggest beefs with our education system and many education systems in the world is we're still trying to get children to produce and demonstrate that they know stuff that they can look up online. You know, why are we, I was once asked if a child could use a smartwatch to cheat in an exam. And the answer to that question is absolutely, they can use a smartwatch to teach an exam. Why are we still asking them questions that they can use a smartwatch to cheat on? You know, if your questions are asked differently, then the quality of the way you use the internet will change.
This was actually a running joke within some circles in schools that the curriculums haven't fully adapted with these times. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, definitely. And if not that, you can go on to some really good tutorial videos on YouTube and find comments that state how one video nicely summarized half a semester's worth of work, which, I mean, personally, I disagree with. You know what I mean? Like, I think anything that is worth doing takes time and effort and energy and sacrifice, you know, on one level or another. So it's not like there's no video that you can just watch for 30 minutes and then expect to walk out of there with the degree. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
These things take time. You gotta, it evolves.
It's not microwave success, you know?
No,
It's not microwave success.
Yeah, keep your 2 minute math.
If these things are at our fingertips already, and when we go into the real world, you don't find yourselves within these testing situations, if you want to put it that way, what is their current purpose with the current curriculum? What skills are they instilling for working within these times?
And I do agree with you around the access and the data. So there actually are lots of websites that have been zero rated. And then there are even some cities who've put in the free Wi-Fi, like the Jersey free Wi-Fi and the Tshwane free Wi-Fi. I suppose the sad thing around that is that some of my students were saying that some of those hotspots have now become crime spaces. So people know people go there to find data. And so they've then become vulnerable, which for me is really sad. But I think that that has to become a really big ask. And I suppose for me in this COVID times and education, a question I've been asking is, why haven't we seen huge tenders going out around devices and Wi-Fi and all those kinds of things? And let's get the devices into the children's hands, because if we flooded the market with devices for children, that they can actually access the information and we teach them how to be responsible, it won't be something that people want to steal, because there'll be so many of them out there, it'll just be like a common thing. So why don't we...
Optimism.
but I mean, if that's the kind of thing that we look at, that we could actually say, let's get these out into everybody's hands. I suppose part of my background is I worked for Google for a few years, and for me, I love Google's Chromebooks. And I know of a whole lot of schools that are actually selling the Chromebooks in their schools as a family device. So when you buy it, it's not just for the child, it's actually for the family. So when it goes home and the teachers then set the work that by 4:30 tasks should be done, otherwise on classroom they set as being late. So you're teaching children to manage their time, not working late into the evenings. But then in the evenings, brothers, older brothers or sisters or parents can take that same device and the child can be logged off and they can log on. And so the device then can be used by other people. So you're making one device being used by multiple users, which then provides greater access. And so for me, education is, yes, your school, but it's beyond that. And so going to the point also around data and access, I think if we have more people having access on devices, and again, what you were saying about smartphones, almost saying to everybody, is your website mobile friendly? How is it from an educational point of view mobile friendly? I mean, most of the, almost all of the new or modern websites, it's literally just clicking on the other button and checking what the layout looks like from a mobile point of view to compare to a device, a laptop computer screen point of view. So I think it's putting that kind of message out there as well. So I definitely agree with you, Colin, from that point of view.
Going back to something that Colin just said, and which Karen just reiterated, are our websites mobile-centric friendly? Because that's what a lot of people have access to in our country, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's something I've not really given that much thought to. But now that it's being brought up, it is a vital question, because if you think about it, a lot of people consume a great deal of their internet content through their phones.
Yeah, and whether you're on your toilet, you know, or you're scrolling through social media, going out for a run, or having, you know, loaded a podcast like the Viral Wellness, or you're just genuinely chilling, or you're just awkward and you don't want to actually interact with real people, you've got this little pocket laptop, you know, to keep you company.
And the amount of time I spend on Instagram, it can be a bit sickening. I won't even laugh. But anyway.
Do you have your screen reports where it's like you've spent 7% less screen time this week than last week? And I was just like, yes. More time in real life.
I actually should do that and make like a rehabilitation. Like
back to reality.
Anyway, and the younger you are, the more you probably rely on it. Some social media managers have been able to function doing press release statements, posters, and a lot of other things all on their phones. So the user experience for it, especially locally, should be cognizant of that. Do you think it is? Let us know in the comments on our socials.
But I mean, talking back to digital universities and digital learning, how is the South African context faring within its development within this space? The fourth industrial revolution has been this buzzword that everyone's throwing around, the government has latched onto in the past couple of years. But how are we actually faring in comparison with the access to this human right that the UN has declared of being able to access the internet?
Are we making the significant strides necessary to get us to where we need to be from an education perspective?
I really, really don't. So another piece of my background is I was at St. Stithians for many years, and I started a teacher outreach project there. When I stopped doing that project in 2015 and handed it over, we had 1,435 teachers that came on a Saturday morning for teacher development workshops. But we also had workshops up in Limpopo, and there we had about another 600 people that would attend those Saturday workshops. And Tandawazi is still happening, and they now have satellites in other Limpopo areas. And I've been chatting to some of the facilitators there during lockdown. And for me, you can really see the gap. And other principals that I've worked with Tandawazi also, who are in Orange Farm or in other outlying areas where principals have been in tears because they haven't been able to get hold of their children or their families, because parents might have changed their cell phone number and that was their only means of connecting because they didn't have email addresses. And so they couldn't even send bulk SMSs, never mind WhatsApps, bulk SMSs to get information to the children. And so I think we are a very long way. And COVID has really showcased this huge gap. And that's why I'm saying, why haven't we seen this mass rollout of getting devices, getting connectivity into these spaces? I live outside of Johannesburg. I don't live in the city. The connectivity here is abysmal. And the crazy thing is I have three different modems from three different service providers, and sometimes my signal is less than one and sometimes one on all three networks. I mean, it's crazy. We should definitely be seeing how do we get access. And internet is king. If we really want access, we need to get it out there. Service providers, I don't think, are being honest to their customers. You pay for a contract with connectivity and then you can't use it. Is that right? And that impacts the learning, whether you're a student at tertiary level or whether you're a child at school or you're a job seeker. Learning as a whole is impacted by that, because if you really want a job today, you need to be online. If you really want to know what's happening, you need to be online. And so therefore, I think that we have a mountain of work that needs to be done to really change and impact and be fair to everybody. So from an equitable standpoint, no, we are very far away from actually reaching that goal.
What I would add to that is not, I wouldn't contradict anything Karen has said, but I would also say, if we do decide as a country that we want to get ourselves to advance in this way, and that we're wanting to get devices into the hands of people so that they can be connected and online, we have to go back a step again, and we have to say, what is our theory of action? How do we believe education can be implemented through these devices so that we and in terms of the theft or whatever that Karen spoke about, if you're limiting what can be done with the device, you reduce the chances that device can be used for anything other than its intended purposes. I've been appointed as the first principal of Advertech's first online school. I'm sorry, Karen, it's called Evolve Online. And I know that that's the same as you. But I promise you, I'm not competing anywhere in your space, okay? The problem that I'm trying to solve is, how do I help a parent who's in a rural context, help that parent to help their child or help the child to be able to participate fully in an online space? So we did choose to use a particular learner management system that is built to be mobile first. And I want to just say, there's a difference between something that scales to mobile and something that's built from the ground up to be mobile. You know, we start with what does this look on a cell phone? And then we worry about what it looks like on an iPad. We don't start with it and then a computer. Yes. We don't start at that end and try and scale it down to a phone. So we've chosen a learner management system that is designed with two things in mind. One is that it can be easily used on a phone device. And the second is that you can pre-download your work so that you don't have to be connected. So you can go to a Wi-Fi hotspot. You can download your lessons. You can download the videos. You can download the exercises. And you can go home and work on it at home. Without needing to be connected 24/7. Being data light is just as important as being data connected from that perspective.
Yeah, and that's very true. So in terms of mobile first, for me, is critical. And then looking at how to use it. So, for example, Google's got a cool app called YouTube Go. And YouTube Go is an app where if you download the YouTube videos onto this YouTube Go app, and then they're offline. They live on your device for as long as you want them. So I think it's set automatically for a month, but you can always extend that length. But it's doing exactly what you are saying. And there are a whole lot of tools around that. And I think that's really important. My only question to you in terms of mobile and phones is, what are we expecting the children to do with the devices? So in my other life, since I've spoken about so many others, I love things like augmented reality and virtual reality and those kinds of learning spaces. And mobile phones are superb for those. And you can really take children into other learning spaces with those apps and experiences. And I think that how we build those into our learnings are just, so that's another story. But for me, if we're wanting our children to write and to communicate from a written point of view, to type on a phone where we're expecting really detailed essays and things, that becomes difficult. So are you saying your children only have one device, or are you looking at a range, or what is the thinking around that?
Well, we've just done a full set of exams online. And we had this hybrid situation where we had some children in class, in the school, because they don't have the bandwidth at home. But they were still using devices, or our devices, here at school. And then the others were just sitting in on the exam from home. When it came to the writing intense tasks, our process was to get the children to write like they would normally do in an exam, and to use the camera device on the phone to take a picture of that and upload that as their exercise. And what is quite nice, Microsoft has an app called Microsoft Lens, which allows you to scan a page, and it makes it very easy to convert it into a PDF. And then because of COVID, you know, we've avoided paper entirely. So even other exercises where children have to write, they're doing the writing at home or in their class, but they're not handing it in, they're sending a picture. And then all you need is an app that allows the teacher to comment on that photograph.
Oh, there are lots of those.
On that PDF.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are lots of apps like that. There's one called AbleWord, which is amazing, and it's free. And that's how we've been handling this issue of writing. And if you can think about, you know, my Evolve Online school will go from grade R. So now how do you teach a grade R child to write? Okay, now, in fact, even on a small device like a phone, there are apps that allows the child to build the muscle memory and to write and to learn how to write their ABCs, even on a phone. But of course, you want that fine motor coordination, you want the pencil grip, you want all those kinds of things learnt as well. And so there are other techniques that you can use. I've mandated iPads with Apple Pencils as the entry-level device. I've also advised an external keyboard so that, you know, kids can type if they have to. But with the Apple Pencil, it becomes the same as writing on a piece of paper. It's an amazing technology. Yes.
There's something incredible that can happen when you put two passionate and like-minded people in the same room for a conversation. You could literally feel Karen and Colin really bouncing off of each other. They just
sounds
like
a dynamic. Yeah, exactly, bro. It's like a dynamic.
Sounds like a dynamic, I know.
Well, I do say it, sir. Yes, we're familiar.
Yeah, it's really, and what's really cool about it is that they unearthed and discussed some really interesting information that I don't think either of us would have had the mind or capacity to task. The magic of podcasts and conversation.
Well, I mean, yeah, in preparation for this episode, we also asked you guys to be a part of the conversation, and we're super stoked to actually say that we're finally at that point where we've got enough responses to actually present it to you guys. So here we go. A few weeks ago, we sent out surveys on our social media platforms. Our R&D team, Yaz and Kibbs, also conducted some research within their own socials. And we got some cool results, right, Kitch?
Yeah, we did. We've got a few anonymouses here.
Yeah, we asked a bunch of people.
Have you tried learning something new during lockdown? And if so, what? Excuse me? VBA. What's VBA?
I actually don't know what VBA is. Do you know what VBA is, Gaz? No, Gaz doesn't know what VBA is.
Whether it's for work or yourself, what tools are you using to learn and train? VBA.
Hold on. I'm Googling it right now. You see, information at your fingertips. Okay. VBA is Visual Basics for Applications. It's a part of the Microsoft Corporation's legacy software. Visual Basic, which means that it's a tool that Microsoft used to help build programs. So,
we want to know who you are, Anonymous.
Yeah,
don't be like this.
It's like a flipping cool quote. You know. It's let us know a great quote, and now we don't know who you are. We don't know where to give credit to. It's kind of annoying.
It's probably like the guy from Assassin's Creed. What's his name? Carl.
Yeah.
It's probably a girl. He's like, they will not know me.
Yeah.
They will not know my whereabouts.
Yeah.
But I did do VBA. Thank you, Viro Wellness.
And I sort of wrote the program that you're seeing right now. Oh, that's Spider-Man, my bad. All right. But we want to share a couple of these answers that we found really, really cool. So like KG said, there's four categories. Have you tried learning something new in lockdown? If so, what? The one that, I don't even know how we should do this, Cage. How do you think we should do this?
No, you've got, look here. We've got Desiree. This one, Desiree Zwane came in.
Oh, yeah, this is very funny.
She says she learns how to sleep longer. What equipment did she use? She used beds and pillows.
Where did she get most of her information from? Sleep.
One website, meditation and sleep videos.
Sleep videos. Yo, dude, what a time, man.
Desiree,
we see you there. You know, and I think it's just fascinating because we've got such a wide pool of things, you know. We'd love to go through all of this, but you know, we got Valerie Kambarami coming in here saying that what she's tried to learn is a new programming language. A lot of people looking at programming languages. And the one that she's taken up is R programming language, which is specifically good for things like data mining. She learned this through online webinars and tools. She refuses to let us know where she got her information from. But the channel that she used, suspicions. But she did use a place called freecodecamp.org for channels that she found most useful, you know?
Ooh, there's a name that we know here, Cam. It's Sutton Kibari.
Kibari Njuguna.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we see so, you. I mean,
guys, this is the overachievers list here.
Yeah, look at this. So for trying to learn something new during lockdown, this legend, what did he do? What does he put down here?
Typing.
Economics. Yeah, happiness.
Happiness. Active citizenship.
And research for the Viral Wellness podcast. Yes! See how much he's learned in this time, right? That's why this makes him a next level achiever.
Typing.com.
Yeah.
He got his sources from typing.com, NitroType, Coursera, the South African Constitution, and reference book where necessary.
Where he found most of his information was he Googled first and then he went through the websites to see what they had on offer. He had a very heavy preference for sites with good referencing, which I think is a very important point on this point, is a lot of these answers, and we have about 14 people here who responded to the survey. A lot of them used YouTube as their sources, which is fine and it is great, but YouTube is so diluted with content that actually I think it's a very good point here that Kibbs mentions, which is, you know, there's a heavy preference for site with good references. And we talked about this, and I know we keep on throwing it back to this, but building blocks of wellness, fake news information, right? If there's no references, if there's no agreements around sources, then it can be very dangerous where you get your sources from, you know? He got his information from also YouTube sites, which shows that they can be valid. Complex, Vox, and CNBC, The Daily Maverick. He got other from news sites, Freakonomics for podcasts, Plant Money, Business Wars, Ted Daily, The Intelligence. You can see he is a wide amount of sources that he gets his information from, you know? And as we've started to pop up with, there's been a few people who have told us about some podcasts that they're doing. We'd love to share those with you at the appropriate time. But it's all about that, guys. It's all about authentic information. And that's what we at the Viral Wellness really want to start, you know, hammering in.
You see,
and actually say
you guys can make it on our show if you want.
Yeah.
All there's going to be a way that you can come onto the show.
Yeah, I see here as well. He's that guy called Tando Umtambo learned Swahili, has been learning Swahili during this time. He said, don't ask us to converse with him yet. He's been using his dad's old CDs and dictionary that he got from work to help him with his work in Kenya. He's been using the internet, and everybody here has listed the internet, which is quite fascinating, you know, that they're consuming content. They're not really, even one person here said, yikes, they wish they could say they use books to learn, but they use the internet. If they don't trust something, they use Google to check it. You know, if someone says something, they use Google to check it, which is both an exciting and dangerous thing, you know. And Tund also says that the Google Translate app came in handy. And he uses Google Translate to also help him.
Also, you know, we want to thank you guys for actually partaking in this.
We really do. This helps us.
Amy, you know? Amy Sefala, Desiree Zwane, Amelia Besta, Tando Mtambo, Kibare. We see him a lot, or we chat to him a lot. Valerie Kambarami, Kanyile, Mokabela, Nsa Mpasa, David Rao Botham. It sounds like we're in like a hall. Like
doing roll call. Reading names and
Valerie.
Yeah. Yeah, but we just wanted to, the point is we wanted to say thank you to you guys. But now it's time for us to ask ourselves the question. Cage, have you tried learning something new during lockdown? And if so, what?
I have, Cam. I have learned a number of things. I have learned a lot in the property game. I have learned a lot about myself, actually, which is very, very important. I learned how to make a podcast. And
I
learned a lot about business. I learned a lot about production. I learned a lot about cherishing your family. There's been plenty that I've learned this lockdown. But I think the most important one is learning about yourself. Know thyself.
Yeah.
And what about you, Cam?
Oof, dude, that's beautiful, man. That was beautiful. I was like, yo, how do I follow that, man? That's amazing. I mean, for me, I think I've learned a lot about international perspectives. I know this sounds really weird, but I've learned a lot about my own country as well. Again, like you said, learned a lot about myself, taking a lot of that time to do it. Learning something new, maybe not so much as keeping the old thing sharp, you know, keeping up acting training. I've learned a lot about the body during lockdown. I've learned a lot about like how to keep it healthy, how it responds to food. Learned a lot about how to like make food properly. Still learning, but time management. Learned a lot about that. And I think also, I know this sounds crazy, but like older texts, you know, like finding myself looking into Shakespeare and looking into like leadership journals, looking into like courses on and information and on people around the world and how to do virtual production, how to, you know, not necessarily learn new languages, but I'm definitely diving into newer spaces. But these are ongoing processes, you know, and there's always something new to learn. And I think like you, we've learned so much jointly, and I'm so happy to say that during this lockdown, and we're going to keep on. We're not going to stop just because like lockdown is like, oh, okay, back to normal life. We're going to keep on learning and keep on growing. And like you said as well, I've learned a lot about love and the people I cherish and care about, you know, and to value those places, and to learn a lot about cleaning and maintenance as well. Yo, dude. Yo, it's been great. It settles the mind, you know, a lot of mindfulness. But where do you get most of your information from, Cage? Because I think ours is a little bit different to a lot of the answers we're seeing here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I've picked up from this list is that a lot of people just turn on YouTube and decide to learn things, as we have mentioned earlier. We've already spoken about how helpful YouTube can be with its tutorials. Even some of the research we've gotten within this show was sourced from some really insightful YouTube channels. So we decided to ask Colin and Karen why YouTube can be so compelling as a source for more personal, individual learning.
I had a child at Sacred Art who taught herself how to play the bass guitar on YouTube. One of the things that I find very strange about education is that we put children together in a group according to their age and expect them all to advance at the same time and the same pace. And then if they advance too fast, then we get cross with them because they're bored and they misbehave in class. If they're not ready to advance, then we get cross with them because they're frustrated and they misbehave in class. And one of the enjoyments that I have as the principal of an online school is that I intend and will be implementing a system where children advance at their own pace. And that they can be 3 years ahead if they like, or they can be 2 years behind, and there's no stigma attached to that because you're just getting the work that you get, you know. It's a complete mastery-based approach. So I think that's a long way around to saying I think that what YouTube offers is a rewind button. If you didn't get it the first time, you can rewind it and listen to it again. I think the founder of Khan Academy has spoken about that. They could rewind his explanation. And I think a lot of our children who've been using Microsoft Teams or whatever and recordings of the meetings with teachers are benefiting from the same thing. They can watch the video again and again. I think it's the self-paced nature of it. You're not having to go at a particular pace. You can slow down. You can speed up if you want to. I think it's the fact you can pause it. So if I'm learning a skill and I want to try it out a bit. Learning how to play a guitar, I can pause it, try the note, and then start it again when I'm ready to carry on. And so it's that choice. And I've always found that choice equals engagement. You know, one of the cleverest tricks a maths teacher can do is when you give homework, don't give the kids 5 sums to do. Give the kids 10 sums and ask them to choose 5. You will be amazed at the greater level of engagement with those 5 questions. And then, of course, you're going to get the kid who does all 10. And the child who's struggling is going to do the easier ones. That's cool, as long as they're learning the skill set. Yeah. There's just not, Corinne's spoken a couple of times about mindset. It's not just about teacher mindset. It's about our mindset as a society to what constitutes education. And I think that your viewers or the people who responded to your survey are telling us that one of the key things that constitutes education is my interest and my willingness to engage with it in my own way. Let's also be aware, YouTube can be a horrible rabbit hole. You can spend 8 hours on YouTube and not learn anything except how people fall off slides and have skateboarding accidents. Okay. Yep. So, it goes both ways.
I also think that from that point of view, it's, again, if you start looking at people and saying, why do they find it useful? I think often in a learning space, in a face-to-face classroom, you'll only have 1 or 2 children who really put up their hands because of self-confidence and fear or ridicule or all the other things. Whereas the video you can watch again and again. Also the teacher's reaction. A child might have a question and has put up their hand and asked. And by the third time where the child is asking a similar question, the teacher is going to say to you, okay, enough now. You know, like do the teacher's body language, even if they don't say it, will be saying, you've asked this, I've answered. Whereas if the child can rewind and watch again and again, they can do it 20 times if they want to. Nobody's going to say to them, no, you can't do that. Because they can suit. So I think that there are a whole lot of advantages. I, for years, have been saying to teachers, we should be recording every lesson for a whole lot of reasons. One, that the children can go and watch. I think two, from a discipline point of view, if something happens in a classroom and there's a confrontation or something happens, you can see points of view from the teacher's point of view and the children's point of view. You can show it to the parents. I mean, there are just so many different kinds of things that we can use that, again, going back to the technology, using technology to really benefit us in a range of different ways.
There's quite a lot that can be unpacked from here. I mean, one of the things being mentioned is that replayability, watching an online lesson or tutorial can have, especially if whoever's giving the lesson is doing it in a really simplistic way. Teachers can get tired with students in a live setting when they keep asking to repeat.
Well, yeah, well, like Karen stated, sometimes the students don't have a calm enough relationship with their teachers or class to put themselves out there and ask questions that actually might really be confusing them. I remember in grade six, a pretty girl was sitting next to me and she kept on asking me, she's like, you know, hey, Cam, can you ask this question? And I was like, absolutely. Put up my hand, asked the question. And then the teacher was like, why are you asking stupid questions? And I was like, you know, but the teacher shouldn't have had that response. The girl should have been able to ask the question and had an honest response to it. You know, like, obviously there are no stupid questions except for questions not asked, is a saying that we've heard. But like, at the same time, you know, I think you can be wise about when you're in a teaching setting, what kind of questions you earn, so that you don't get lost in it, you know?
No, 100%.
But, you know, like, yeah, it's important for people to put themselves out there and ask questions for clarity without the fear of looking dumb or facing ridicule.
But the other thing which Karen mentioned was about using technology to benefit us in different ways, specifically in ways that can better track what's going on in our classroom to keep students and teachers alike accountable.
This both from a content perspective as well as seeing how we behave. Here's what Colin has to say about this conversation.
The Finnish Minister of Education was asked why they don't have a school inspectorate in Finland. And his answer was, I have 27 inspectors in every class.
Yes.
I love that idea. And I think that the impediment to what you're suggesting, Karin, is the lack of willingness to be held accountable that is quite prevalent in the education spaces of South Africa and the way the trade unions support that agenda. And it's their job to do that. I mean, the trade union is there to represent the people that they're employed to represent. So I'm not faulting the trade union for doing that. That's their job. But I am faulting this mentality of you can't hold me accountable. That's not my fault. And that then leads to just teach this and this and this in this order, so that I can at least be sure that those things get taught. And then the minute you ask to be taught for something else to be taught, the answer that you get back is, but you told me to teach this and this and this in this order. So, you know, that there's so, and I'm the one who said, let's look beyond the negatives. But the way to do that, I mean, one of the artificial intelligence tools that I'm using is something called QBot. What it does is it captures all the questions that children are asking. So when they ask a question in a group or when they ask a question of their teacher, it captures that, and then it captures the answer that the child has given. And then eventually what starts to happen is it starts to know the answers to certain questions. So you don't have to even wait for your teacher to answer the question. QBot says, other people who have asked this question got this answer. Does that help you? And if it doesn't, then just click this button and I'll send it through to your lecture. But what's very cool is the way the children can help each other with answers to those
questions. Exactly.
And then all the teacher has to do is moderate those answers to make sure that the children are giving good answers to those questions. But it's just, this technology has leapt so far ahead. And education, and I know that there's some people who are tired of hearing this, but education has not traveled along the same journey in terms of adoption of technology as what other industries have, as what other aspects of society, even churches are sometimes further ahead in their adoption of technology than what schools are. And they're one of the most conservative spaces you can hope to find in a society.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that I want to pick up from what you said. So one, in terms of using technology, but your description of teaching what, sort of telling people what to teach. I really think what COVID has done in terms of being pro teachers is showing us the importance of the teacher. And I really think we need to speak teachers up. I really think that we need to say, teachers are why you can read. If we didn't have really good grade one teachers, we wouldn't be able to be where we are. And so the relationship that you have with a teacher, if we look at what's happened with MOOCs, the MOOCs that have been most successful are where there's been the relationship with the lecturer and the course notes, that people where It's just been online and no engagement. The dropout rate there has been very high. So you have thousands of people signing up and very few finishing because there isn't that relationship, that engagement. So teachers are exceptionally important. And then saying to teachers, I think it's going back to saying to teachers, how are you allowed to be creative? How are you allowed to take this content and turn it into your own? How are you proud of your teaching space? So I know for all the years that I taught, I loved all my classrooms. So I was always excited when I knew somebody was going to come in and actually look at my classroom and see what was in there, and was even saying to parents, you can come and sit at the back of my classroom anytime. You're welcome. Come and see what we are doing, because I felt comfortable for my space. And I think it was because the principals I had at the schools were happy with what we were doing and so empowered us to be ourselves. I think empowering teachers to say, you are in your classroom, be creative, enjoy the work, get to know the content, I think is something which over the last few years we've lost, where teachers have been pushed into a funnel to think in a certain way. And in fact, in some spaces, they're not even setting the tests and the exams. So you're not even encouraging the teacher to think creatively in terms of questions. And then their kids do badly on assessments because the questions go into higher order thinking, but they're not teaching like that. And so for me, teacher development is vital. So that's the one thing. The other thing, data. And no, not data, AI. I really think if you think of all the information schools have, if you just think of SAPS and what SAPS is accumulating from all the schools in the country, how is that data being fed back to the schools to say, this is working, this is not working, this is amazing? I was in a presentation a few years ago, which was a UNESCO meeting where they'd been working with countries globally. And we were in India, and the minister from Oman was demonstrating the platform that they'd implemented for schools. And when it first started, he said that some of the teachers were saying, this is very invasive, that you want to know what time we arrive and what time we go away and all sorts of things like that. He said, but in the long term, what they found is, for example, in the schools, teachers were all falling pregnant just before the school holidays because the maternity leave was so short. And so they changed that policy. They saw the results of the rural schools were not as good as the urban schools. And then those principals and communities started saying, but you send us teachers who are almost forced to go there and are not the best teachers. And so they looked at how do we actually do that? So they used the data to really improve the education system, to help the teachers more, is the way he explained it. And I'm thinking, how are we using the data? How are we using the data to help our students? Never before in the history of people have we had a facility where we can make personalized, individualized learning as easily as we can with technology. If we're really using the data, we can make very individualized learning. I think when I first started teaching and you wanted to do group work, I used to sit on the lounge floor and put the books out into the groups that I wanted and say, okay, these are my groups for maths and these are groups for English. And then next week you'd physically have to do that again. If you're now using the data and sorting your data and putting in algorithms and things into your spreadsheets that it sorts the way you want it to. So sometimes random mixed groups, sometimes your different ability levels, sometimes. And so you can be using the data much more effectively than we are, even with what you've got. So teaching teachers how to use the data that they've got. Teachers often just put marks in and then it's like looking at the final mark and okay, we've done. Where actually, that's the first step. What you've got to be doing is actually analyzing that data, saying, what does this mean for that individual child? What are we learning from this thread? How are we actually making the learning individual for the children? So using the technology to make individualized learning for our students, I think is where we can really start using the technology.
Okay, dude, I flipping love the fact that I have a laptop here because I can Google what MOOC means. Ah! How's this? It's MOOC. That's apparently its phonetic spelling.
MOOCs.
Nukes. Nuke. Nuke. It's so funny, dude, the way that they say it. Nuke. Is an online course that is free and accessible to a large amount of people. So the acronym is MOOC, is a massive open online course. So this would be a course or syllabus that has been made available to a lot of people online. So I guess in some ways, the viral wellness could be a MOOC, you know?
MOOC. So MOOCs have become very popular within the last couple of years. One of the most common sites for these is Skillshare. If you've watched a lot of YouTube essays and edutainment content, you'll often hear of Skillshare being one of their main sponsors.
Another one of these classes online, which has been really celebrity heavy, which we've already talked about, is Masterclass, which offers a course taught by industry leaders where you can learn, you know, things like how to sing from Christina Aguilera. You can learn how to direct from Martin Scorsese, or how to play tennis from Serena Williams.
Yo, that would be epic. Imagine getting a tennis lesson from Serena Williams.
Exactly, dude. But can you imagine? It's like, hi, I'm Cameron Scott, and I'm going to teach you acting and imagineering. And now you do yours, Cage. You do your masterclass introduction.
Hey, guys. Play like Olympic music in the background. Do you want to know how to bowl? Well, you've come to the right place. Come with me, and I'll show you everything you have to know.
Hey, I think I'm going to sign you up for a masterclass on how to do presentation speaking. Come with me, guys. I will show you the way.
Come now, this way.
Come this way. Way. Off come. We go. My goodness. Oh, wow.
What do I need to talk to? Masterclass reps, let me know, please. Cam's got my number. Hit me up. But yeah, the other things was SAMS. So you have SAMS and you've got MOOCs, but now we're going to talk about SAMS.
SAMS.
SAMS is the South African Management System. It's a database schools have access to and used to upload stuff like marks and or assignments. It generates what tasks need to be achieved, etc., etc.
Okay, and it can be very easy to get wrapped up in the wonder of online learning. And the truth is, for a great deal of time, COVID forced us into this way of adopting a new primary method of learning, you know?
Yeah, exactly. We know that within South Africa's landscape, it's not as sustainable right now, but it could be in a hypothetical future, which begs the question of what the value is in traditional teaching.
Yeah, are there still things that can really be gained and cannot be replaced from physical touch and being in the same room and physically present with someone? And I already know this, like, right now, Cage, I way prefer having you sitting right here. I mean, we can do this is fine. You know, this is great, and it's awesome. But I think, having you across the table here, that's where the gold's at.
Exactly, that is where the gold is. But it's so funny, we're talking about how we're gonna do this when I'm on tour, and we're actually doing it.
Yeah.
We did also say that Viral Wellness is gonna be the biggest podcast in Africa in the next 5 to 10 years,
and then the world.
You know, I don't have to say anything there.
We don't have to say anything. We don't have to say anything else. This is our masterclass. The guy who teaches the ukulele, I really want to have.
Hopefully, we can do a masterclass.
I would love that. Yeah. Soon. Masterclass, you know where we at.
I think, you know, I'd absolutely jump in and say that human contact aspect is the most massive difference between online. And what my teachers have found very difficult to cope with is, you know, you have these, because we don't have cameras on, we're trying to preserve children's bandwidth. So all you've got are these alphabetic initials on the screen in front of you. You also have to ask children to switch the microphones off so that microphones don't interfere with the process. And so you can't even hear children's reactions to what you're saying. children can't read your body language. They can't, you can't see that a child isn't getting it through the body language of the child. So that, and you know, the American teacher, one of the American teachers of the year once said, children don't care what you know until they know that you care. Mm. And that, I've always lived by that. I think that a child who feels safe learns. And that includes psychological and emotional safety. And it's very often the teacher that creates that emotional and psychological safety. Yeah. And the tragedy is that a lot of children get away from their traumas by being at school. So what COVID has done for those kids is they're stuck 24 hours in stressful situations, in abusive situations. There is no escape. There is no ability to get away from that family space. And particularly if you're living in poverty and you have very limited space to work in. So I think the biggest difference between brick and mortar and online is that human interaction that takes place. And like Corinne has already alluded to, the most successful online teaching is online teaching that takes cognizance of that and then deliberately builds in social interaction into its encounters. You know, that you require children to engage with one another, that you have events that take place that children can participate in. That's how an online school needs to move. Just taking what happens in a classroom and trying to replicate that online doesn't work. And we know that now because that's exactly what we've tried to do. And we've learned that, you know, you can't replicate a face-to-face in-school encounter online. And that's a big difference.
I would just say, so for me, the difference is exactly what Colin has said. But I think if I look at some of the successes that we've seen during COVID, so schools that were using technology and have then flown with it, how that's been successful. So, for example, if I look at, say, for example, what St. Albans has done from an interview
Or Abbott's College, Joburg South. Yeah.
What they did was, so they're a Google school, so their teachers were really comfortable, their parents and children were really comfortable with the tech, but what they did was they did things like they did tutor groups going up through the grades and within the grade. And every day they had I think it was a 10-minute session with both the mixed group and the grade group of those children. So they had not a lesson, a social engagement, so building that relationship. What they also did online was they carried on as if school was continuing, in terms of they had their whole school assemblies. They had their whole school events. So everybody was involved in these whole big things, as well as in the smaller group discussions, intimate type things. There are other schools which have looked at support. So one of the schools in Joburg who is a remedial school, what they did was they actually didn't focus so much on the schooling in terms of school lessons at first, but carried on with all their different support therapy type people who made sure that they engaged with the students at the beginning of lockdown so that the children actually felt comfortable and were coping within the space, and then they wove in the teaching and the learning. The other thing in terms of virtual that have also been successful is that you don't have a video conference lesson for an hour. That's just silly. And so what lots of teachers were finding at the beginning is they were doing these long lessons, particularly in high schools. Children would have their cameras off and would have their mics off, and they would just disappear. The teachers would ask them questions, and there was nobody around. But they were online, but they weren't there. So how do you engage with your students during the time, keeping it short, succinct, and then looking at how do you actually, when they're offline, do they know what to do and how do they reach out to you? So what's the tech that you use? Is it, if you're in Google, is it the chat? If you're in Teams, is it the chat? So that the teacher is not on the same call with people for the whole time, but can have lots of little groups within their class, and you can really start doing differentiated task work in your calls. So not doing this whole class thing, because to have 20 little pictures, you can't actually get everybody talking. Whereas if you've got small groups, you can engage nicely with the students. You can actually get all their opinions. They feel valued. So therefore, that engagement and the respect, even though it's online, you're actually valuing from that point of view. So even though you can't physically be with the children realize you're listening to me. You're hearing me.
I'm seeing what Karen said earlier about valuing teachers. I think it also has to be noted that our teachers went from one methodology of teaching to another within 2 weeks with minimal training. And then when the schools were opened again, they went to a third methodology of teaching without any training. I do think that our teachers, and there was one point during COVID when the reputation of teachers and the appreciation of teachers was peaking. It was really, you could see a lot of comments of appreciation toward teachers. And tragically, I think we've slipped back into being critical of teachers again since schools have reopened and blaming and that sort of thing. So I do think, I think it was Fullan and Hargreaves that said, the quality of a country's education system can never exceed the quality of its teachers. And that's true. And just also with, in relation to what Karen has said, there's a wonderful podcast called The Cult of Pedagogy. And the latest podcast on that is talking about moments of genuine interaction and how one creates moments of genuine connection between a teacher and a child online. So if you are going to go online, if you are going to do online stuff, you've got to build these connections into it because that's what makes education is a relationship first and content second. You know, and if you don't get the relationship right, the child will never learn.
Hey, welcome back to Cam and KG's Masterclass. On this episode, we're going to continue with the next part of our episode that we've already been talking about. I think it works, dude. I think we've got to package that and send it off to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. So what you want to do is when you're speaking, you need to speak. Speak.
Properly.
When you're speaking, you must speak. I think we need a masterclass on how to give a masterclass.
Yeah, exactly. That, so if someone can do that properly, then let's do that. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say any names, but John C. Maxwell, if you want to chuck one in there, then I'm not complaining. All right, but back to what we were talking about. From what Colin and Karen were saying.
It's true. It's true of a lot of things in life. You know, the relationship is what forms the bond. It's that added bit of spice that can make or break you. With sports, relationships inform chemistry.
Yep, and in film, relationships form that secondhand communication that allows you to communicate more effectively. You know, this thing called subtext is, for multiple reasons, but one of the reasons people don't like necessarily always going to the theaters because for a large part, a lot of acting for many people became about this like big over-exaggerated communication, you know, and what we actually want to see is like real life nitty gritty looking at somebody in the face and being like, hey.
So, look into my eyes.
Into the windows
what
of
do
my
you
soul.
See? Yes, what do you see? And that gap can already feel big when you don't have a way of identifying with the teacher in real life.
And continue to emphasize so often. And the last few months have probably been the most turbulent times for the education sector. And it's so important, especially where we're going into our future. We care about the wellness of our country and the world and of our people. And people, we've got to take education as something that's leading the forefront of this fight, you know? We know that most schools are already unlikely to finish their curriculums by the end of the year. I mean, flipping the matrix, dude. Matric Vac and Matric Dance, you know, there's all these rites of passage that have gone out the window, you know, and that's secondary to the actual importance of learning that needs to be done. But there's a lot of problems that we've covered within this episode alone. So simple solutions and others that are are quite complex have presented themselves. But we did ask Colin and Karen some of the initiatives that they would like to see implemented to bridge the technological gap in our teaching. And here are some of their thoughts.
I think one of the things that Karen said about these Wi-Fi spots, we started a project at my previous school called 3 to 6, which was a refugee education project. And as an outcome of that, we were heavily involved with the schools in Yeovil, the primary schools in Yeovil particularly. And we started a second project called Ndlulamiti, which, as you probably know, is the Zulu word for giraffe. And the idea behind that is that the children should be able to eat the freshest leaves at the top of the tree and not have to settle for the rubbish that's fallen on the floor. And part of the Ndlulamiti concept was to roll out Wi-Fi hotspots to within the schools, because we were worried and concerned about that whole safety issue. And schools pay for security. So there's, you know, you want to, if you're going to roll those things out, you've got to think about safety issues. But there is a fantastic resource called Rachel. It's a device. Do you know about it, Karen? It's a device that's produced by an NGO called World Possible. And what it is it's literally a Wi-Fi spot with a hard drive in it. And you can connect up to 32 devices to it at any given moment. And it has a version of Khan Academy on it. It has a version of Wikipedia on it. It has a whole lot of reading books. The African Story Project is on there. And it's a local resource, so it doesn't rely on data for it to be usable in a place. So one thing the government could do to try and bridge this divide, they're not expensive. They're about 5,000. Last time I bought one, they were about 5,500 rand. And to roll that out to our schools so that there's a... And you can charge them with solar. So even rural schools that don't have bandwidth or electricity could still, if you give them 30 devices and one of these things, and you do some training of the teachers to use it and to access it, you can then really make, that's a very quick win for me. You know, you could have children having a digital experience. I agree with what Karen said about augmented and virtual reality. There's some remarkable tools. Google Cardboard is dirt cheap. It's just a piece of cardboard that you fold and you put over your face, but you put a device inside that and a child can go to the moon, be under the water. Yeah, that's the more expensive version, Karen. You know, the cardboard version is actually nothing. It costs less than 5 rand. But I go back to what I said earlier. Don't just go ahead and do these things. They will become white elephants, like so many initiatives have become white elephants. You have to have a structured rollout. You have to have people who will champion it. You have to really project plan this thing to death. You've got to do so much detailed thinking that there's no question that can be asked that you don't have the answer to. You know, you've literally got to go down to, okay, so now I have this. What happens next? What happens after that? Backward map the experience so that we make sure we make the gains. And measure. Hold people accountable. Sorry.
I agree, Colin. I agree with exactly what you're saying. But for me, I think that devices are the one thing, but you've actually got to get the teachers on board. So for me, the thing that I think the government needs to do is prioritize teacher development, teacher professional training, or whatever words you want to use like that. But one, we've got to help them change their mindset that it's not difficult. Two, we've got to show them how technology can save you time, because the technology can really save us time. If we used auto marking for all the knowledge and recall questions, and the teachers went in and moderated the analytical and higher order thinking questions, it halves your amount of marking. So using the technology to save teachers' time. If we taught teachers how to collaborate on a document and to collaborate and share, that you're sharing resources. So not everybody's making their own resources, but we're actually sharing those resources and saving time. But it's teachers' mindset. It's teachers' changes. Often as teachers, we think it's mine and I'm not going to share it. It's how do we actually get teachers to start engaging and sharing, that we actually build the community so that people are willing to share and we learn from each other, but it saves us time in the long term. For me, that's where digital is amazing. It's not like you've Ronio'd or photocopied a worksheet and then it lives in the file. It's now digital. To tweak it, it's easy. You hop into last term or last year's file, you change it for this year. So for me, it's teaching people how to do that, how to manage the tech. And just as there should be a mass idea in terms of the practicalities and milestones around that and accountability for that, the same should be for the people who are going to be on the ground using the technology. I think if we really want it to work, we really need training around that. Just as we have training around curriculum, and if we want curriculum to be implemented properly, you need really good, effective training or a culture of a school or whatever it is the school is trying to do. People need to understand what that culture is. People need to understand what are the aspects. The same is for if you're doing a mass rollout, you're just doing it on a bigger scale. And so it's starting with the people and alongside that doing the whether it's the rooms and the devices and everything that goes along with that.
If you rationalize those auto-marking aspects of the curriculum across the entire country, you start to develop the kind of data lake that you need to understand where the problems lie. You know, the heat maps that I'm just imagining you could create out of that. The ability to target and use artificial intelligence and machine learning to analyze what is happening in the learning spaces in our country and to target the kind of interventions that we need in the different places. The ability to make sure that, you know, if you think about what are the benefits of a online course, I only have to employ the best teachers in the country. I only have to employ, well, theoretically, the world. I don't need to get a teacher to tell my kids about a theory of something or another when I can get the person whose theory it was telling them. Why would they listen to it third hand when they can get it from the source? So the other thing that I would have to say is that if the government is going to do something like this, they must from the ground up build machine learning into it. They must make sure that everything that can possibly be measured is measured. You know, how many times do children watch a video? How many times do they have to try this sum before they get it right? Children who struggled with this sum in the past and did this and this and this or watched that video then succeeded. Now we've got pathways to learning for children. Whereas before we just have to guess at what to do when a child struggles with something. The accessibility features of devices, particularly the Apple devices, but other devices as well. You know, the read out loud, the features that are there for blind children, for deaf children. The sky's the limit is in terms of what you can do. But what's missing mostly, I would say, is a vision of a possible and optimistic future. What we do instead is we get so tied up with the problems of our country and the problems of our world. Yes, we've got those. But with COVID, we've learned that we can actually turn things around in 2 weeks.
I agree.
You know, the resourcefulness of South Africans there is no equal to it.
But are there any low-hanging fruits here that can be easily implemented? We asked each of them if they could think of at least 3 to help us out.
Are there any low-hanging fruits?
So for me, the low-hanging fruit for me is a tool which I've been exposed to over the last few months, which I think is phenomenal. And it covers both your literacy type tools, your maths type tools, and all your 4RI tools. And it's, for me, really cheap. So it's called Purple Mash, and it's by Too Simple. And for me, when you play in this tool, the teachers can set the work, the work is marked, that there are a whole lot of resources. So I think it's something like 10,000 resources that are already pre-made. And you can go from, if you're trying to teach any productivity suite, those tools are there. But on top of that, they've got coding tools in there. You can create games, games in there. You can create animations. You can create art. The most amazing art pictures within the tools. There are music tools. I had music teachers so excited the other day because the children could create their own digital music. So all of those are Fourth Industrial Revolution tools, teaching children animation, gamification, teaching. There's a tool where they can design their own 3D objects, and then you can download those with SDL files so they can be 3D printed. I mean, this little tool has just a mountain of resources, and the cost is crazy. If you've got more than 300 children, it works at 60 Rand per kid per year. I mean, just the concept of that is crazy. So for me, that tool from a primary school right up to grade 7 is phenomenal. It's really, really phenomenal, just what's inside there. And I think it's so big. So for me, that's the one. I know Colin likes Microsoft. I really like Google. So I think what Google offers from a productivity suite in terms of Google Classroom, how you can engage, that your calls are right inside your classroom. If you want your meets, they're inside your individual classroom. So if a child belongs to different subject teacher classrooms, it's built inside your Google Classroom. Your marking is there inside your Google Classroom. And then all your different tools fall into that space. Your classroom can be categorized so beautifully and easily within that space. So for me, that's my other tool that I would say. And the cool thing with that is going from tiny babies all the way up to matrix. And then going back to a Too Simple tool for tiny, tiny babies is called Mini Mash. So there they've got a tool for preschool children where in both Purple Mash and Mini Mash, you can upload videos as the teacher. So what we've seen during COVID is teachers creating little videos of themselves explaining to their little preschoolers what they need to do. They hop into their trays to find their work. There's a pin so it's easily accessible for them and they can see what they're doing, so their literacy activities, and it looks like a preschool classroom and an outdoor space, so really user friendly. So for me, those are my three.
And I'm conscious of time. I would say that they should negotiate, or they should make it a condition of any cell phone license for any cell phone operator, that they have to zero rate all educational traffic on the web. That would be a quick win for our entire country. Second thing I would say is, you know, I've spoken about the Rachel server, but there are simple tools that you can use, free tools that you can use to make it possible for children in rural areas to also bridge the gap, the divide. I'm not a Google, Microsoft, I don't care which one you use, just for the record. But the last thing I would say is, you know, getting the devices into the hands of children.
Yes.
But restricted devices that are designed specifically for learning and can't be used and therefore aren't targets for theft.
Well, this has been a very educational episode.
Yes.
An online educational episode.
That was exactly like World War II online propaganda. An educational episode. An online educational episode. I mean, we've brought education to the forefront, and we would like to thank our amazing guests, Colin and Karen, who have brought through a wealth of knowledge and insight. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really fun to see their chemistry and how passionate they were and how they just bounce off of each other. Like, you know, it was their first time that they've ever met, and they were just...
How funny is this? How funny is
this?
We're
in symphony.
Symphony. Yo, Cage, bro, you were a poet and you knew it, bro. You were a poet and you know it, bro. Right there, in symphony. That's beautiful. I've got to say that to someone at some day.
They're in symphony.
My symphony. Yeah. You know, but a fun fact about them, speaking of symphony and synchronicity, is that they both have their own companies called Evolve, you know, that have to do with learning. So, you know, when we first approached them, we thought that they might even be part of the same company, but it turns out not. They're both part of two separate companies called Evolve. They have different methods, though, and both are trailblazing in their fields. Yeah, like I said, they're on completely different spectrums, but they're centered around this similar concept, which is learning and remote learning.
That is crazy. But as we always do, we like leaving you with some final words from our guests. And here is what they have to say with regards to steps you can take within your journey in digital learning.
Okay, so for parents, I would suggest that you, because I know that a lot of parents are struggling because their children are at home, I would suggest you go and explore Khan Academy. Absolutely, because it not only, and go and look at the COVID resources for Khan Academy, because what they've done there is they've actually created daily schedules, daily programs for children to follow. And I think that would be very, very useful. Even if you're a teenager in high school where your school's been closed a lot and you're worried that you're falling behind in your education, Khan and I'm assuming, of course, that you've got bandwidth to do that with. Okay, if you don't have the bandwidth and you do have the textbooks, get together in collectives. Remember, you've got to be wearing those masks. You've got to be more than a meter and a half apart. Don't put yourself at risk doing that. But 3 or 4 or 5 of you get together and learn together. Set goals for yourself. Use YouTube. Again, I'm trying to think of ways that are not too data heavy, but if one of you has the data, then use the downloaded version, watch the video together, discuss it. The other thing you can absolutely do, whether you're 5 years old or 55,000 years old, is read. Just read. Improve your reading skills, improve your vocabulary. Just find something that engages you in the reading sphere, and then discuss that. Discuss that around the family dinner. I think one thing that COVID has done for us is made us remember that we're in families. So talk to people, read and talk. You know, those two skills are two of the most core. You talk about 21st century skills. Those are the core 21st century skills, the ability to absorb information, the ability to debate and discuss that information. So that doesn't need bandwidth. That's just, you know, finding stuff to read and reading about it and discussing it with others. As for myself, I'm currently the principal of Abbotts College, Johannesburg South. At the same time, I'm the principal of Evolve Online Digital School, which again, Michelle, it is different, I promise. And we've got a website, evolveonline.co.za, and you can find my bio there. You can make an inquiry there to talk to me if you want to, or you can email me. I don't know if you guys are going to just put our emails in the comments below this particular vlog or YouTube channel. Just throw it in underneath. I'm hoping you can edit all my messing around there and trying to get a word out. But see Northmore at evolveonline.co.za. I also run webinars. I'm running one next Monday. I generally run them once a week or twice, once every 2 weeks, talking about different aspects of online learning and digital learning and that sort of thing. So feel free to reach out. I'm very happy to chat to peeps. And I think Corin and I are going to have lots of conversations after this. I think we're two very like-minded individuals.
So, thank you for having me on this chat. I really enjoyed it. For me, I think in terms of what advice, I think one, we've got to realize that we've got to take care of ourselves And so what you're hearing over and over again because of COVID is that people are stressed because of the long working hours and not realizing the divide. And you're hearing that from parents, from people who are working, and from people who, and from children as well. So I think using tools like Google's got tools for YouTube to actually monitor how long you've been online and things like that, perhaps switching those on. And on some of the phones, like on iPhones and some of the Androids, it actually messages you and says to you how long you've been online. I think that's something to consider if you're online a lot. I know that for me, I've got to be aware of it. And then I think in terms of how do you engage and what learning can you do? Find something that interests you, something which you are passionate about, something that you want to explore, and go and research that and verify that, and then build something around it. And for me, it's not necessarily that it's all digital. Perhaps if you're interested in learning how to build a car. So my background for many years, I taught design and technology. So go and find out about something and go and physically build it and then play in the digital space and perhaps start a blog if you are over 13. Or if you're younger than 13, perhaps parents, you help your children to document it, that the children can learn to use the tools. But start making it a family space. So we talk about how COVID has made us aware of our families and maybe sitting down and having meals. But what about where children can start preparing the meals for the parents and recording that as a blog or as an activity? So find something you're passionate about and use the time to research that. For me, in terms of learning, use the tools to also help you. So, for example, if we're looking at the pressure in terms of end of year exams and matrics and things like that, see if there are resources that you can find online, like Khan Academy. And there are a whole lot of other kinds of resources like that. Just Google the topic that you want and go and see what other websites, or maybe there's a YouTube channel, maybe there's another organization. So for me, it's be inquisitive, explore and learn. But at the same time, think of yourself, think of your family and engage, have a chat, talk about what you've done. So my personal information, I am Karen Walstra. I'm an independent educational consultant. I work with schools and with teachers in terms of educational change, with and without technology, actually. And in terms of how do we think differently? How do we engage differently with our students? How do we actually work? So you can find me in two spaces on the web. I have a website called Karen Walstra Consulting, and I have a website called Evolve School. Yesterday, we ran the first 12-hour Evolve School webinar, where we had 20-minute slots of corporates and ed tech people presenting, and then amazing panel discussions last evening. And that was really fun and really informative. But we also do a whole lot of other webinars and one-on-one chats. So reach out, engage, and thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
It's been a pleasure really having you on.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so don't forget to check out Khan Academy, Evolve Online for Colin Northmore, Evolve Learning for Karen Walstra, as well as her own consulting.
And we'd also like to thank them both for their invaluable information that they brought to this discussion, as well as the people who contributed to our surveys, and we're loving the audience interaction. Let's keep it up, guys, and let's just keep on raising the roof, even if it's internationally. Right?
So that's another episode, guys.
That's another episode. Ooh. Coronavirus. Coronavirus cases. Let's hit our tradition. So.
Yeah, okay. So coronavirus cases so far. Also learned how to like read numbers in the millions. Yeah,
I know. You may have noticed from our last episode that it's quite a feat, you know? We're not saying anything, but...
Coronavirus cases, 26,812,749.
There have been 879,247 deaths. And recoveries are at the number of...
Tell them, Cam.
Oh, okay. I was pausing for dramatic effect. There have been 18,921,056 recoveries.
And there we are, guys. Thank you for taking the time of listening. I'm Kagiso Rabada.
Cameron Scott. And this was our masterclass.
On online learning. Literally a masterclass, though. Literally
a masterclass. All the masters in the class. Mrs. X is there. Digital universities are there. We grooving.